Sony will stop making Betamax tapes next year. Who knew they still were? VHS tapes dominated the market from the 1980s until the DVD, and they're now disappearing with downloads. We're joined by Bill Hammack. He's an engineering professor at the University of Illinois and host of the popular YouTube channel The Engineer Guy. Thanks very much for being with us, Bill.
Glad to be here, Scott.
Looking back, with your sense of history, why did Beta lose out to VHS?
Well, at first it's a little bit puzzling. I actually have a Betamax machine in my studio, and it is a beautiful machine. It is heavy. It's very smooth in how it operates. But that's the first part of the problem. At first, the VHS machine was much lighter than the Betamax. The Betamax weighed about 36 pounds, the VHS 29 pounds, and that doesn't sound like a big deal. But when you're mass manufacturing an object, it impacts everything from material cost to assembly time to shipping cost. So at the low end of the market, the VHS machines were cheaper than Sony's Betamax. And second, the earliest Betamax played for only 1 hour. That's the maximum size of the tape. And from the very beginning, VHS was able to play for 2 hours, so they could get a whole movie. And then that's where the ultimate killer came in, is Betamax focused its energies on time shifting. And their ads featured headlines like, watch whatever, whenever. And JVC, the maker of VHS, created relationships with the nascent video rental industry. And as that market grew, the VHS grew. And for a while, you could find both types of cassettes on the shelves. But then VHS just took over.
There are lots of examples of this sort of thing. Isn't there, when there's an emerging technology, it goes in one direction and then somebody wins and somebody loses?
Yeah, and there's also a lot of cases where these technologies were just a little bit before their time. I mean, one of my favorites is the picture phone.
Yeah.
It came out from Bell Labs, or Bell Telephone, actually, in the mid-1960s. And if you're a man of my age, you can remember seeing these at the Epcot Centers and World's Fairs. And Bell,
the movie 7 Days in May made a big thing of picture phones. Yeah.
Yes, they did, and that was exactly about the right era for that. And Bell spent some $500 million in order to create an amazing network where they anticipated that they would have a $1 billion business by 1980, that they'd have 12 million subscribers by the year 2000. Yet what happened was 71 people used it in its first year, and then 6 years later, that fell to zero. But what they did almost brought us the internet, because they had little gadgets on these that you could use 35-millimeter slides, and a business person could show data to another person. And so they came very close to developing the internet in the late 60s, early 70s. But by 1978, they withdrew the phone, and it lost $500 million for them.
I always thought the drawback to the picture phone, as I thought it through, was that you can't be in your underwear and talk on the picture phone.
I think that there is quite a bit of truth to that, and that there had to be a culture that would use it. Now, I do notice that my sister and I use FaceTime a lot. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that a video conference was always a by appointment, and usually we're talking to a boss. But now what I'm noticing is that culturally people begin to use it. Just my sister will ring on FaceTime instead of making a phone call. So I think that's changing, but it had not changed at the time at all.
Yeah. Do you think there are any tips as to what makes something click and catch on, and what are some of the drawbacks?
Well, I would like a pithy answer to that. But what I always remind my students when looking at engineering failures is to remember Tolstoy's the opening to Anna Karenina, which is, all happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So when these failures, we look for kind of a simple uniform explanation. But really what we have to do is we have to go in and look for a very rich and a very textured story. But in general, if you're going to disrupt the technology, you have to bring in something that is substantially new and different. A favorite example of mine is the Dvorak keyboard. We have a certain keyboard called a QWERTY keyboard. If you look at the upper left-hand corner, there's the five letters, Q-W-E-R-T-Y. I guess that's six letters, isn't it? right?
Thanks, Professor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there was a man named Dvorak who came up with a different kind of keyboard, a different arrangement, and while it did allow people to type faster, it was only about 5 or 6% faster, and that's not enough to really displace the technology.
Yeah. The mood ring, I understand, was almost something else entirely.
I love the mood ring. In the 1950s, a man named James Ferguson came across a kind of liquid crystals that would respond to temperature. And he really wanted to use them to diagnose disease. And he'd learned that if you take a thin layer of these liquid crystals and you paint them on the body, you get this very dramatic swirl of colors that reflect the temperatures under the skin. And mm-hmm. they could reveal, you know, circulatory problems of hemophilia, arthritis, diabetes. And he even came up with a way to detect breast cancer. But this never really took off. And instead, as you point out, its final use was in the mood ring.
Oh, my word. Bill Hammack at the University of Illinois, the engineer guy on YouTube. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.